I wanted to begin by more explicitly than I would normally do, talking about the question of why this series. For 2,000 years, Jews dreamed of the possibility of returning to Zion. And when it finally became a possibility and a reality, for many Jews, it could not but be freighted with religious significance. Hayinu kecholmin, right? We were as dreamers. A dream of so many of the Jewish people had been fulfilled. And yet, I want to make three, I hope not super controversial, observations. One is that a majority of American Jews know almost anything about what religious Zionism is and has been, who are the major figures who created it, what are the central questions that troubled it, the aspirations that animated it. In fact, I would say even very few American Jews who consider themselves religious Zionists could begin to answer those questions. And so the first goal of this series is to introduce some of the major thinkers and players and the burning questions that lie at the heart of religious Zionism. The second, this is perhaps less uncontroversial, is that many American Jews feel, in one way or the other, or in more ways than one, that religious Zionism at some point in its history, we can debate about when, went off the rails. And one of the things I want to do in this discussion is begin to explore the question of what that might mean, and if it's correct, when and why it happened. And then finally, maybe least uncontroversially, I think there's a kind of conspiracy between religious Zionism's enemies and some of its most impassioned champions to create a picture of religious Zionism that is fundamentally monolithic and univocal. That is, it has one voice on theology, on politics, on culture, on all kinds of other questions. You could have that impression from reading a newspaper, and you could have that impression from reading many self-identified religious Zionist publications. And one of the things I want to do is complicate that monochromatic picture by beginning to uncover the sheer range and diversity of views and perspectives that have animated the history of religious Zionism. And that said, I want to emphasize this is not primarily a class in history. It is, I am going to try not only to look backwards, although we're surely going to do that, but also to try and look forward and let voices emerge from the past that could be useful for the future unfolding of religious Zionism. It's actually striking that many of these voices are basically unheard of even among religious Zionists in Israel. I will talk about this a little bit in the third lecture on Messianism, but one of the most striking things I have ever read in the time I worked academically on religious Zionism is a woman named Geula Bat Yehuda, who is sort of like one of the, and I mean this non-pejoratively, the house historians of the religious Zionist movement. She writes a biography of Yitzhak Yaakov Reines, who we're going to talk about at length tonight. And she begins the biography by saying, when I started writing this, I found it extremely difficult because I couldn't understand how it was possible for one to be a religious Zionist without being a Messianist. It simply didn't make any sense to me. And yet here she is writing a biography about, if there's one person you could describe as the founder of religious Zionists, it's Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, who, I'll say this very carefully, at least in some of his writings, is not a Messianist. And that, in other words, is because the picture of religious Zionism has been entirely, I wasn't planning on saying this, but has been entirely cooked, right? That is, it has been totally rendered into a monolith where there is Rav Kook, and then there's a few footnotes along the way. And I want to open that up a little and complicate it. Now, one word about why we at Machon Hadar think this series is so important and this topic is so pressing. Right? It is increasingly the case that you can meet young religious Jews who say, I am passionately religious, but Zionism doesn't mean anything to me. And without, for the moment, making any judgments about that claim, for the moment, I want to just observe that if one is serious about saying Jewish liturgical words, and one aspires to mean what one says, to at least engage with the question of Zionism is actually unavoidable. Right? It makes no sense to say, I'm going to pray all the time for Jerusalem, but the fact of Jews in Jerusalem in a way that it is unprecedented for thousands of years doesn't interest me, is actually to be basically, I think, incoherent. So, without, in that sentence, closing off any options for what it might mean to be a Zionist, I want to make it clear that to have this conversation is fundamental to what it means, I think, to take Jewish tradition, identity, and certainly liturgy seriously. Now, regarding the structure of this series, so those of you who know me know what I'm really interested in is texts and ideas. And that's where we're going to focus. We're not going to do the history of institutions, and we're not, as I hastened to emphasize in the announcement, this is not a class in the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's not a class in the history of the State of Israel, although to be sure, everything we're going to talk about has implications for those issues. We're going to mainly think about questions. And through thinking about questions, we're going to meet significant figures. Tonight, we'll start with some historical backdrop, moments and issues that I think are really fundamental for getting a sense of where the questions we will address in the next few weeks map onto, what the kind of intellectual and historical map looks like. And then next week, we'll move to topics. And just to sort of make clear for a minute the questions that I want us to explore, next week we're going to talk about the land of Israel, and specifically, I'll ask the question this way. Is there anything in the world that you're willing to say is intrinsically holy? Not just holy because it's important to me, but holy because it's holy in itself. That question has vexed the history of Jewish thought about how we think about the people of Israel and how we think about the land of Israel. And that question only became more burning, more pressing, and much more repercussive. That is, it had much more impact, the way we answered it, with the emergence of Zionism. That's next week's topic. Then, in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about the most explosive topic, I think, in 20th century Jewish thought, the relationship between Zionism and Messianism, or the non-relationship between Zionism and Messianism, and the different understandings of how one thinks about that theological question, how the answer theologically might or might not affect one's postures politically. In that particular discussion, we'll also meet those figures who were not in the mainstream of religious Zionism in that they steadfastly refused to understand Zionism as a messianic unfolding. Perhaps the most significant figure in that litany is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, and we'll talk about that at some length. 3 weeks from now, we're going to talk about the question of violence and military force and how Zionists have reckoned with the, and how one articulates the next word is extremely important, how one reckons with the problem, the promise, the concession, the miracle of Jews for the first time in thousands of years having an army. And we'll see the way in which through much of the history of religious Zionism there's a tremendous ambivalence about the need to have an army until Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who we'll talk about at length, who will then valorize and celebrate Jews having an army. The fifth lecture, we'll think about the ways in which religious Zionists have attempted, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully, or have resisted the project of Hafnamat HaDemokratia, internalizing democracy as a Jewish value. And of a piece with that, we'll also think about perhaps the most vexed question theologically for religious Zionist thinkers, which is how to understand the phenomenon of Jewish secularity and the ways in which Zionists attempt and often fail to grapple with secularity. And then finally, the last week, I'll try to say a few words about what I have come to call Tzionut Datit Acheret, what a different religious Zionism in the future might look like. And I will say that with the caveat that I am standing and living in New York, and it should be heard with that caveat. I'll make one pledge, right? I will be expressing some of my own views about many of these thinkers and the political and ethical questions they address, but I really will always do my best to present them as clearly and accurately as I possibly can. And I'll say finally, before sort of shifting to the topic at hand, that this probably goes without saying, large swaths of the Jewish world have proven just how difficult it is in this day and age to have civilized conversations about Israel and Zionism. I always like to say this, if you want to sort of become profoundly pessimistic about the possibility of civil dialogue, I have one word for you, talkbacks. And if you think talkbacks are bad here, you should look at the talkbacks on Ma'ariv and Yediot and Haaretz, right? And the level of sort of vitriol. And I just want to sort of suggest and encourage that during the time of question and answer and response that we model a different kind of conversation about Israel and assume one another's good faith. Okay, that's all I want to say by way of introduction to the series. Now, moving on to the topic at hand. Religious Zionism is and has always been a minority project. And I don't think it can actually be understood without an awareness of that. And by a minority project, I mean two things. One, that religious Zionists were a minority within the Zionist world, and, as we'll see, were extremely conscious of that fact, and often nurtured feelings of inferiority, inadequacy, the real Zionists were other people, and their sort of feeling of marginality within the Zionist world. Second, and simultaneously, religious Zionists were a minority within the religious world. An enormous majority of religious Jews in Europe and an overwhelming majority of traditionally oriented rabbis in Europe were not only opposed, but often vociferously opposed to the Zionist project. So there's a way in which religious Zionists often had an understanding of themselves as, in some sense, besieged. They're a minority in two directions. Minority within Zionism and minority among the religious. Now, in what could be in itself an additional lecture in this series, I want to say just a couple sentences about what that opposition among religious people to Zionism was. And I think it's very important to tease this out. There really are, you could say, two versions of opposition to Zionism among traditionalist Jews in Europe. We'll call one the moderate version, and one, I don't want to call it extreme because that's not what I mean, the one the more purely ideological reason. The moderate reason is, look, it's a secular movement run by secular Jews, and we, as religious Jews, don't make ourselves an appendage to a secular project. Right? It's a judgment based on who's in charge and who's animating. For example, the Soloveitchik family. Right? Its opposition to Zionism is largely rooted in that version of opposition. But, and this is really crucial, right? There is also a prevalent view that says, even if every last Zionism were a self-professed frum Jew who kept Shabbat kosher and only ate, you know, the frumest of the frum, right? Zionism would still be a sacrilege because it is a theological violation, namely, it usurps a prerogative that belongs only to God. God is the only one who can bring us back to the land. You have no right to do so. And one of the things, this is just kind of a passing observation, one of the things that is interesting about religious Zionists is that very often they deceive themselves that if they can solve the first problem, the rest of the Orthodox rabbinate will come along for the ride. Right? If we can just take over and have a majority of Zionists be religious, then there'll be no more opposition. Rhinus, who we'll talk about like that at length. Right? But in fact, what they miss is that very often there is another layer of opposition that is much more profound and fundamental. Some people have suggested, and I'm not sure the research is in on this exactly yet, that sort of bigadol, in broad terms, you can say that the first moderate opposition is characteristic of the world of the Misnagdim, and that the second, more ideological, theological opposition is characteristic of the world of the Hasidim. It is certainly the case that the most extreme versions of the second are held by Hungarian Hasidim, people you know of as Satmar, Munkacs, out of which grows Nature Karta, or as we mispronounce it, Nature Karta, and other groups. Okay. So one of the things... let me leave it there. Okay. So now, on the sheet, the outline that I gave you, I talked about wanting to think about four moments in the unfolding of religious Zionism, and I want to begin with a moment that can't really be described as religious Zionism at all. It's far too early for that, but which is a really interesting precursor to the unfolding of religious Zionism, and that is simply a letter. A letter written by a relatively not well-known rabbi in Germany, called Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. In 1836, in the summer of 1836, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer writes a letter to the Frankfurt Jewish banker, Amschel Rothschild. And that letter, which will later be expanded into the first sort of religious Zionist manifesto, a book called Drishat Zion, that letter is an attempt to rethink Jewish messianism, and to call the Jewish people, and Rothschild in particular, to action in hastening the Messiah's coming. And one of the reasons I find this letter so interesting is I think it's a really important moment of transition where incredibly uneasily in Kalischer we find deeply modern and profoundly pre-modern assumptions and the weaving together of a kind of almost systematic rationalism with a commitment to mysticism and even theurgy. Does the word theurgy familiar to people? Theurgy means the idea that a ritual that takes place here can shape the direction of God and the cosmos. Something I do here, for example, the most theurgic line that many of you are familiar with, right, is when Jews often say, L'shem yichud kudsha brichu u'shchinte, right? I'm going to do this mitzvah in order to unite God with God's Shekhinah, right? That something I do down here will affect the heavens up there. Okay. So Kalischer's premises are these. He says, God is active in history, but God needs a prominent human being to serve as his agent in history. That means that Rothschild is potentially a messiah. Mi yodea im la'it kazot higata la'malchut. Who knows? Quoting the book of Esther, maybe it's for this reason that God has orchestrated an unprecedented access to power and wealth for a Jew. Now, Kalischer will then say something that becomes the dominant motif in religious Zionist writing and self-justification. He says, let me clear up a misunderstanding. Messianism is not a sudden transformation whereby everything is changed, but a slow, gradual process. This theme will emerge again and again and again among religious Zionists who need to explain to their critics, how come things don't look that different? And actually, sort of as a footnote, I think one of the interesting phenomena you find in the history of religious Zionism is, on the one hand, a theology that says, slowly, slowly, and on the other hand, a growing, growing, growing impatience. New already. If it's really the messianic period, let's get on with it. Right? That's a deep and unresolved tension. But Kalischer is, in a way, the first voice that says, kim'a kim'a, a little bit at a time. Kalischer describes an ordered process. He has a deeply structured view of how the redemption is going to unfold. And you'll see, as I describe this, how the integration of the modern and the pre-modern, the rationalistic and the theurgic go. So there are four stages that are going to happen. First, God is in the process of orchestrating a scenario whereby the Gentile kings will allow the Jews to return to Palestine. Footnote. Okay, you may remember that one of the most important pieces of Talmud that gets rehearsed over and over and over again in debates about Zionism is the pledge that the Gemara in Ketubot says that the Jewish people took, Shelo Ya'alu Bechoma, not to go up by force. And Kalischer beautifully deflects the force of this text by saying, who said anything about force? I'm looking for permission. Okay? So the first step is, God orchestrates permission for the Jews to return to Palestine. So far, total naturalism. Second of all, the Jewish population in Palestine swells. Third, the Jews rebuild an altar in Jerusalem and offer sacrifices. And now here, watch the transition. Fourth, God is moved by the reach nichoach of the sacrifices. God is moved by the sweet smell of the sacrifices, and God's hand is forced, and the full-on redemption begins. Now, I love this letter because I think it's an amazing, really, really is an amazing moment of, on the one hand, here he is talking in this totally modern, unprecedented language. How should we go to the Temple Mount? Mr. Rothschild, write a check to the Ottomans and buy it. Right? And if they won't tell you all of Jerusalem, that's okay. Buy the Temple Mount. And if they won't tell you the Temple Mount, okay, we'll live it. Just buy enough space to build an altar, because if we build an altar, God has no choice at that point. And by the way, if you're interested in the history of halakha, Kalischer will go on at great length in a halachic investigation of demonstrating that it is permissible to have an altar without a Beit Mikdash that contains it. Right? Here's another interesting footnote. What did all these rabbis in Eastern Europe say to the Reform movement? How dare you talk about not having sacrifices? Kalischer says, I don't get it. Do you guys mean it or not? You keep attacking the reformers, right, by saying, no, we don't want to do away with sacrifices. We believe in sacrifices. Okay, so I'm trying to make them happen. Now, no, right? There really are two stages to the messianic process. The first accords entirely with the laws of nature, is totally naturalistic, and the second is totally supernaturalistic. It's miracles, Nisim Gluyim, and the Messiah arrives. Now, Kalischer has done a great piece of yeshiva learning, as it were, consciously or otherwise. Traditionally, Jewish philosophers thinking about the Messiah asked the following question. I mean, they asked many questions, but one of the central ones was, would redemption be a naturalistic process or a supernaturalistic one? A gradual process or a sudden one? And Kalischer comes along and says, both. It will be a naturalistic process to get it going, and then there's a supernaturalistic moment that takes over. It will be a gradual process first, and then there'll be a sudden moment of transformation. The work that a two-stage theory of messianic unfolding does for him is allow him to say, in good traditional learning form, there's no machloket, right? There's no debate. They're both right. Now, it's important to note, right, this is not Jewish nationalism conventionally understood, as we might talk about it. He's not interested in some political notion of Jewish sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael. He's actually interested in skipping all that, acquiring the Temple Mount, and thereby ushering in the Davidic kingdom, right? There's no way in which he's engaged in some political Zionist project. He's a precursor to Zionism and not a Zionist. I don't think it makes sense to talk about him as a Zionist. But what is important is that the book version of this letter, which comes out a couple of decades later, sort of sits prominently on the desks of many religious Zionist thinkers as they, 50 years later, more like 70 years later, begin to sort of articulate a full-blown theological justification for Zionism. Interestingly, we have no proof that Rothschild ever even received the letter, and certainly he didn't respond to it. And it's actually interesting to speculate whether, this is kind of just for the historians among you, whether Kalischer really thought that Rothschild, a fairly secular Jew, could follow the kind of halachic argumentation that he felt was important in this piece. It's also striking that it never crosses his mind that most Jews living in 1830 might not be on board with the theological assumptions that animate this letter. Right? And that in itself is also an interesting piece. Okay. So we'll leave that, and of course, we'll take questions or comments about all this later. Now the second moment, which is where I think it makes sense to actually talk about religious Zionism as a phenomenon. And that is the birth of the movement known as Mizrahi. Now Mizrahi, a lot of people actually strangely don't know this, Mizrahi is an abbreviation of the phrase Merkaz Ruchani, a spiritual center. And as a movement, it's founded in 1902, and it is, I'm going to talk about this much more at the end, it is a deeply revolutionary development. It is really the first time in Jewish history, I think you can say this, where religious Jews identify themselves as a political entity within a larger structure that is fundamentally secular. Right? They join the fundamentally non-religious Zionist movement. I'm not sure that if you went back sort of scouring through Jewish history, such a thing would even make sense, let alone have precedent. It's so unheard of that for many, it's completely scandalous. And we'll come to that. So, in the interest of meeting interesting figures along the way, the founder of Mizrahi, Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, and spellings of names and their dates are on the sheet that you have. Reines, who we will see, we will meet again and again, is born in Lithuania, moves to Palestine as a boy, returns when his father loses all his money, and much of his family is killed in an earthquake in Svat. He comes home, he becomes a student in Volozhin, in the most sort of prominent yeshiva in Lithuania, after which he becomes basically a communal rabbi in various cities. And his sort of signal contribution in the world of learning has nothing to do with Zionism. He is a person who, possibly under the influence of reading Kant, is interested in the idea that he can take all of rabbinic literature and systematize it. And he writes this well-known, very difficult text called Chotem Tochnit in 1880, which is published in 1880, which is this attempt to systematize all Talmudic learning. In the early 1880s, he tries to found the first modern yeshiva. That is, one that lechatchila, right, as a value, integrates secular and religious studies. And already as a result of trying this, he is a deeply controversial figure among his rabbinic colleagues, and the yeshiva totally fails and closes quickly. He will try this again 20 years later and be somewhat more successful. Now, this is where he gets interesting for our purposes. As Reines becomes more interested in Zionism, he becomes a steadfast devotee and lover of Herzl's. And he will often be criticized for the depth of his loyalty to Herzl, who I once found a letter in which Reines addresses Herzl. This is actually one of my favorite moments in modern Jewish writing. He writes a letter to Herzl in which he addresses Herzl as Morenu Harav. Now, if you know anything about Herzl, you know that Herzl didn't understand the words Morenu Harav and couldn't read the Hebrew letter that Reines sent him. Right? But Reines is so convinced that Herzl has this enormously important role to play in the unfolding of Jewish history that he sees him as a kind of mentor. He addresses him very often as Achi HaYakar, you know, my sweet brother. After the Third Zionist Congress in 1899, Reines becomes a kind of full-fledged member of the Zionist movement and really the leading figure in religious Zionism. And an extremely prolific writer of books, many of which are attempts to justify religious participation in Zionism. Okay. So why did Mizrahi emerge? And the answer here is perhaps surprising to many. It's not really the same reason, at least not explicitly, as the reason why the Zionist movement en masse emerges in the early 1880s. Right? It emerges. The Zionist movement is precipitated by, we'll say, the pogroms of 1881 and the disillusionment with Europe that results. But Mizrahi has a slightly different precipitating factor. There is a debate, an often ferocious debate in the Zionist world at the beginning of the 19th century, the 20th century. I'll say it in two pieces. One, should the Zionist organization be involved in cultural and educational activities? and to what extent? And two, how should we define the content of modern Hebrew culture? What's its relationship to Jewish tradition on the one hand, and to the Enlightenment on the other? Right? That is not a small question, by the way. Right? That's like, what is modern Judaism? Right? But that question is hugely on the table. And Herzl's position on this is, please, could we not talk about this? Right? Herzl is very smart about this. Herzl basically says, if we allow ourselves to have this conversation, any hope for a Zionist movement is over. Because we will kill each other. Right? If we actually allow ourselves to debate the content of modern Hebrew culture, we're finished. So let's table this discussion, preferably for all eternity. Right? Now, the Russian Zionists come along and say, and here I'm sort of simplifying Zionist history, but I hope not falsifying it. What do you mean table this discussion? This is why we're Zionists in the first place. We want a solution to the question of what is modern Jewish culture? And you're telling us that that conversation is prohibited. Now, if you ever took a class on the history of Zionism, you know that the standard way to understand the enmity between Herzl on the one hand and Achad HaAm on the other is that Herzl thought that Zionism was an answer to the question of the Jews, and Achad HaAm thought that Zionism was an answer to the question of Judaism. Herzl was uninterested in Achad HaAm's question, and he thought it was actively detrimental to his cause. Achad HaAm thought Herzl was kind of like a false messiah. You think that moving to Palestine is going to solve the problem of anti-Semitism for hundreds of thousands of poor Jews. Good luck. Right? Actually, the best thing that Zionism could do is help us figure out what a modern, secular, but still engaged with tradition, Jewish culture would look like. Now, the different biographies of the two camps are telling, right? The Russian Zionists, the ones who are engaged in this advocacy for Zionism being about culture, are largely people who had traditional educations, felt burned by them, and felt disdain for the anti-modernist rabbis who taught them in yeshiva. And so the most important thing in the world to them was, keep those rabbis' hands off the Zionist movement, and let's have a conversation about which parts of the tradition we want and which parts we don't, and figure out what modern Jewishness will look like. In contrast, the Western Europeans, like Herzl, came from fairly assimilated backgrounds, and for them, Zionism was part of rediscovering an interest of in Jewishness and Judaism. And so they, some of you may recognize these two voices based on people we know, had a certain kind of romanticism even about what Orthodox Jews could symbolize for them, right? I'm going to give all my money to Chabad, right? No, not a standard American Jewish trope, right? Because they symbolize authenticity. And these biographies are completely at loggerheads, and therefore these ideologies are completely at loggerheads. What happens essentially at the beginning of the 20th century is that the Russian Zionists organize themselves into a political structure to fight for Zionism being focused on culture. That's what's called the Democratic Faction, a Fraktia Demokratit, right? Led by a guy you've heard of named Chaim Weizmann, but also supported in different ways by Martin Buber and others, and claiming that Achad HaAm is their teacher. And here's the very simple sentence I want to say about the origin of religious Zionism as a structure. Mizrahi emerges as an attempt to fend off the Democratic Faction. That is, religious Zionism emerges as an attempt to fight off Zionism taking on the question of culture. This is sort of ironic, right? Religious Zionism emerges to say Zionism should only be political. Let's solve the question of the Jews and leave the question of Judaism aside. Because if we take on the question of Judaism, they, like Herzl, know we're going to break down. Now, it's one of the great ironies of Zionist history, although if you understand the issues, it's not so ironic at all, that Reines loves Herzl. Pardon me for not speaking in my own voice for a second. The Chazer-fressing Am Haaretz Herzl, right? The pig-eating ignoramus Herzl, right? He loves him. But Achad Am, who knows much of Tanakh by heart and is versed in rabbinic literature, is like, to use a non-Jewish phrase, the Antichrist. Why? Because Achad Am has a project to reimagine Judaism. Herzl doesn't know enough to care. So, ironically, religious Zionism hitches its wagon to Herzl. What this means is that Mizrahi is essentially, in its origins, I mean this word not pejoratively, a propaganda and literary office meant to fight off the culturalization of Zionism. Right? To fight off the achanamization of Zionism. And Reines is convinced, wrongly, that cultural Zionists are a small and insignificant group of elitists, and they can be fended off through numbers and convincing Zionists more broadly of just how destructive cultural Zionism will be to the plausibility of Zionism as a movement. And this is a very convenient fellowship. Herzl is convinced that religious Jews are the best source, potentially, for people who will move to Israel. And Reines is convinced that Herzl is the best opportunity for actually being allowed to do that. Mizrahi even, and here I sort of say this because if we go back to the image of the monolith of religious Zionism that many of us imagine, Mizrahi, even to great controversy, follows Herzl on the Uganda question. Reines supports Uganda. Now, I will talk at great length in the lecture on Messianism about why that is, but Reines unequivocally says we should say yes to Uganda. Now, it's a temporary measure, but we should say yes to it. By the way, I think it was also a temporary measure for Herzl. Herzl wanted to take Uganda because he thought that from Uganda he would have a better case to make for Palestine. Right? I think it's a total misunderstanding of Herzl to say that Herzl thought, oh, Uganda, and that's fine. I think that's actually, and most of the historiography on Herzl now is pretty much on that page. In other words, again, Mizrahi, at least in theory, is interested in the question of the Jews and not the question of Judaism. So that in many of his writings, not all of them, we'll talk about this in the Messianism lecture, but in many of his writings, when Reines is asked to define Zionism, he essentially says, Pikuach Nefesh, saving Jewish lives. That's the business I'm in. That, by the way, is a very compelling answer in his mind to a question that bothers all religious Zionists. How can you cooperate with secular, ideologically secular Jews? He says, I don't understand. We cooperate with them on philanthropy all the time. Right? I mean, if someone is dying, I don't check the other person's tzitzis. I ask, will you help me save them? That's what Zionism is. Pikuach Nefesh defers all ideological debates. So Reines attempts and wants Mizrahi to be a middle ground between secular Zionism on the one hand and widespread Orthodox anti-Zionism on the other. He's convinced that Orthodox anti-Zionism only deepens antipathy to Torah and religion among young Jews. But here's the problem that Reines faces. He never really succeeds in articulating a strong and coherent version of what Mizrahi stands for as opposed to what it doesn't stand for. And that might be a result of some built-in ambiguities in his thought that I'll talk about in a second. But it's so much the case that in 1927, Moshe Avigdor Amiel, another prominent religious Zionist thinker, this is now 25 years later, says, it's amazing, we've been here 25 years, we still don't have an ideology. We still don't know what we're for. But here's the tension in Reines that I think is really interesting and that is, as far as I can tell, totally unresolved in his thought and may be the reason why he can't work out a developed ideology. On the one hand, as I already said, he thinks Zionism, or so he says, is a humanitarian ideology, right? It's aimed at saving Jewish lives. Its agenda is purely practical. On the other hand, he says, Zionism constitutes tshuva, Because how can you really be returning to peoplehood and land and not on some level be returning to Torah too? Now, we will have occasion to spend a lot of time over these weeks talking about how dominant that last sentence is as an assumption among religious Zionists and how much trouble it gets them into in terms of making sense of secularity. But the point here is that it's not clear at all whether the following two sentences can sit together. Number one, Zionism is only about politics. It is a purely political project, and that's what it should be. Number two, we should really try to get some more Torah involved in Zionism. Because after all, it's a tshuva movement. And Reines is unable, it seems like, to work out this tension. And in a way, I think, is even paralyzed by it. And he will be attacked from all quarters as a result, as we'll see in a minute. Now, Reines' leadership is called into great question when in 1908, at a Zionist Congress in Minsk, Reines realizes that the cultural Zionists are going to win. So he says, okay, let's create two streams of education, religious and secular, and I'll accept what Achad HaAm says in good faith. We'll build it on the premise of mutual tolerance. And the result is a truly uneasy, unhappy status quo that in a certain way persists to the present day, right? Two contradictory views of the nature of Jewish culture coexisting in what's supposed to be one movement. Right? That's what emerges in 1908. Reines, of course, faces a lot of people who then say, wow, for a guy who founded a movement in 1902 to resist the culturalization of Zionism, it took 6 years for you to cave. Right? And Reines essentially says, what's the alternative? I would fight it off and they would do it anyway and it would all be secular. So I have to make this worldly choices. Now, in a certain way, there's a kind of tragedy, right, to Reines, is that he always hoped that the emergence, not only hoped, I think assumed, that the emergence of a large contingent of explicitly religious Zionists would melt away Orthodox opposition to Zionism. And in fact, the opposite happened. Right? Mizrahi actually served to strengthen, ironically, Orthodox opposition to Zionism because Reines was accused of essentially giving a heksher to heretics. Right? What do you mean? You're in the same movement as they? You're part of a secular movement as, like, the token guy with the yarmulke? I'm supposed to find that impressive? You've just basically legitimated everything that's wrong with modernity. Now, part two of this moment. Interestingly, one of Mizrahi's most ferocious and consistently outspoken critics was a man named Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook. What is ironic about this, not only ironic, in a way paradoxical, is that over time, Rav Cook's ideas are so influential and so compelling that he becomes, as it were, the official theology of Mizrahi, a movement he had tremendous issues with. And his own political activism and his own rhetoric was often fiercely dismissive of Mizrahi. Over time, and we'll talk about Rav Cook in almost every lecture we have here, over time, Rav Cook finds himself in a very lonely place as a critic both of Haredi anti-Zionism and of the Mizrahi version of religious Zionism. Reines, he says, not by name, is too passive. He's not willing to really fight for the heart of religious Zionism. He's willing to sort of take the bone they throw him. And the Haredim walk away from the greatest possibility in 2,000 years. Haredi attacks on Zionism, he says, are simple-minded, and they don't understand at all the complex ways that God might be working in history. Now, Rav Cook, and this has sort of been cleaned up in the sort of official histories of Zionism and Mizrahi, Rav Cook has some extremely fierce things to say about the leadership of Mizrahi, whom he accuses at one point, in one of my favorite phrases, of zachlanut, obsequiousness, servility, right? You lick Herzl's boots. You need to condemn unequivocally any attempt to toss off and move beyond Torah and tradition. Now, if this sounds different from the romanticizer of Cook you might have been taught, some of you in 10th grade, it is. And we will talk about that at Lent in the coming weeks. Rav Cook was profoundly ambivalent. In one and the same essay, he can often say incredibly glowing things about secular Zionists and their idealism and tear them to shreds. His problem with Reines is that he only does the former. Which is not totally fair, but, right, Reines is not willing to have an ideological battle for the heart of Zionism. He is fundamentally passive, or so Rav Cook thinks. Or to put it differently, religious Zionism, Rav Cook says, has to be more unequivocally both and unapologetically both. That is, Zionist and religious. To put it in another way, when Reines, in his public writings, and again, in the Messianism lecture, I will suggest that Reines is a much more complex figure than the way he was usually understood. Reines, at least in many of his public writings, basically understands Zionism as a material political movement aimed at solving the material political problems of the Jews. Rav Cook says, that's impossible, and it's unacceptable. There's no such thing as Jews engaging in something that is only political and only material. The Jews are a people intrinsically tied to God and Torah. I literally don't understand the words you're saying. And so Rav Cook attempts to found his own movement, which he insists will not compete with Mizrahi, but rather he generally suggests Mizrahi is welcome to join. In 1918, he founds a movement called Degel Yerushalayim, which falls apart almost instantaneously. Rav Cook is a thinker, not an organizer. He says, I want a religious Zionist project that is a partner, not a branch, of secular Zionism. What he calls achva, and not being a snif. We can be friends with them, but I'm not going to be part of a movement that defines itself as secular, which is prohibited and incoherent. A movement, he says, that's going to be based in an unwillingness to compromise, and whose project will be to reveal, and this sort of will telegraph a lot of what we'll talk about Rav Cook, reveal the holiness that's already implicit in the ostensibly secular work of mainstream Zionism. There's a lot more to say about this, and I won't say it now. I'll just say this. There is a line that I believe is attributed to Herzl. Hatzionut davar ein la im hadat. Zionism has nothing to do with religion. Herzl says this to keep everyone, as it were, happy. Reines is willing to go along with this. Rav Cook thinks that is like an out-and-out sacrilege with a capital S. What is Zionism? Am kadosh al admat kodesh. A holy people on a holy land. How dare you even talk about Zionism that disconnected from religion? What is the basis of our claim on the land anyway? You think we're some species of European nationalism? Oh, so we're just basically a form of assimilationists. They're nationalists, so we're nationalists too? Our nationalism is different, he says. Now, what's interesting and sort of ironic about this is Rav Cook is convinced that unlike Mizrahi, I will succeed in bringing the Orthodox on board with Zionism because I will not be guilty of the Zachlanut. And of course, he is ripped to shreds for trying to create a Zionist movement, and he fails. So both the Mizrahi and the Aguda basically say, we don't want anything to do with this character. The interesting thing is that until much later, when the folks who start Gush Emunim discover Rav Cook is not yet Rav Cook. It's very important to understand that. Rav Cook is a fairly marginal character. Yes, he's the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, whatever that actually means at that point. But he is certainly not the ideologue in chief. And let's put it this way. Religious Zionists in 1945 are not sitting and memorizing Rav Kook's books. They've never read them. It's very important to understand that, right? It's almost inconceivable from someone living 40 years after the 1967 war to imagine that there was a time when religious Zionism did not equal Rav Kook. And yet, that's exactly what religious Zionism was for a long time. Okay. Moment three, and this I'll say it very quickly, okay? Because I think it has interesting precedent, and that is the debate over partition in the 1930s. What's called in Hebrew Pulmus HaChalukah. 1936, not going to sort of do a rehearsal of Zionist history, but 1936, we have the Peel Commission. And the Peel Commission in 1937 makes a recommendation to divide Palestine. And most religious Zionist leaders, lay and rabbinic, are opposed. They see accepting partition as demanding. This is actually very interesting. They see accepting partition as demanding a principled surrender of their right to the entirety of Eretz Israel. And it's actually a minority of voices who say, why are you making that assumption? Why is it not possible to take what you can get, have a theoretical right maintained, but not the practical ability to achieve it? But one of the terms you find coming up a lot in religious Zionist conversation in the late 30s is the notion of Ktav Vitur. I really don't know how to render that exactly in English, like a letter of surrender, right? That if we accept the partition, we are basically surrendering our claim on Eretz Yisrael. And neither the theological right nor the political desire to do that. By the late 1930s, partially as a result of this, the religious Zionist world has moved, you might say, from the center of Zionist politics to its right. For many, it's the messianic dimension of Zionism as they understand it that is determinative, or depending on your perspective, that is the obstacle. That is, and this I will talk about at length, for most messianists, one of the things that comes along with messianism is a commitment to all or nothing. If it's Mashiach Zeit, right, if it's a time of the Mashiach, then we have to have everything. So almost to a head, the messianists want to say no. Interestingly, some people later express regret. Like the major Zionist leader, Yehuda Leib Maimon, will say after World War II, if I knew then what I know now, I would have said yes in an instant. Right? If I knew that I was really saving lives by taking the... Totally. I didn't know what world I lived in. Now, I want to bring to your attention a totally obscure figure, because I think this is very important and we're going to come back to it later on in this series. One particular religious Zionist thinker who is opposed fiercely to accepting the partition, by the way, the whole notion that like these rabbis' opinions were going to be determinative is interesting, but one of the rabbis he asks is a guy named Reuven Margoliot, himself something of an interesting scholar, and Reuven Margoliot writes a little tshuva to him, in which he says the following interesting thing. He says, look, I'm totally opposed to this. I do not think we should accept partition at all. But by the way, this is not a halachic question. This is a question about politics. Why are you asking for psak? This is, I want to suggest, extremely important. And by the way, the next person, and this one much more influential, who will do this is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, right? Interviewed in Ma'ariv in the 1970s. And is asked, what do you think of land for peace? And says, why would you ask me that question? I'm not a security expert. This is not a halachic question. And one of the things that's sort of interesting, and this is maybe a piece for our last, thank you, a piece for our last session, is that in the last, it's hard to figure out where to date this. Let's just say a process that probably began in the 70s, that's intensified dramatically in the last 15 years, is the halachicization of every political question that religious Zionists face. Right? That is the notion that every political decision, one has to go for psak. That is not at all clear in the history of religious Zionism that that should be the case at all. And in fact, as if I have time at the end, I'll say there are parts of the religious Zionist world, Torah v'Avodah and other people, who are actively opposed to the notion that we go to rabbis to help us answer political questions. I go to rabbis for tuna fish. So Margoliot is an interesting moment of saying, wait a second, I don't even understand why you're asking me this question. By the way, I don't mean to suggest that that's unequivocally an easy argument to make either. I just think it's interesting in light of where the conversation goes. Now, in unbelievably sort of truncated way, I want to just sort of suggest that there are really three camps in the religious Zionist world around partition, but more dramatically around the question of Zionism's relationship to the Arabs. By the way, this watch is glare. I have no idea what time it is. What?
8:35.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, first, there's what we might call the religious Zionist right, which operates with the commitment to non-recognition of any Arab national aspirations in Eretz Yisrael, and whose project is the pursuit of a Jewish majority and a Jewish state, and a total opposition to partition. By the way, you should not assume that any of these positions are uniquely held by religious figures, meaning in some ways these are mirrors of the larger Zionist project. The most well-known person in his time arguing this is a man named Shlomo Zalman Shragai. Right? We believe in Shlemut Haaretz, and there is no Arab national movement that we can ever recognize. The middle is sort of messy and hard to define. They are committed to the pursuit of a Jewish majority and a Jewish state, but they also talk about the desire and the need to reach some kind of compromise and agreement with the Arabs of Eretz Israel, and they recognize that, let's go back to what I was talking about a minute ago, whatever theological right they may have to the land, political realities mandate something else. Right? Political realities mandate partition. The names Yehuda Leib Maimon, Meir Bar-Ilan, who are two of the kind of most central leaders of the Zionist politics, they are kind of the two leaders of the religious Zionist middle. And then there's the religious Zionist left, which then as now is small. And one of its commitments is to recognize the aspirations of the Arab national movement in Palestine. The desire for compromise based on the recognition that there are two competing nationalisms in the same territory and that there has to be some form of resolving that. The names who sadly very few people have heard of these days, one is a man named Yehoshua Radler Feldman, known by his pen name, Reb Binyamin. This is a very different time, right? Radler Feldman, who is a prominent member of Mizrahi, is also a member of Brit Shalom. Right? Is also a member of the movement towards a binational state, which argues for, in their language, language that is often associated in Jewish life with Buber, Rabim Velo Rov. Many, but not a majority. More kind of mainstream in the religious Zionist world, but still identified with this commitment to recognition of Arab aspirations, is a figure named Moshe Una, who we'll have a chance to talk about, who's a major figure in the attempt to bridge Zionism and socialism among religious Jews, and we'll talk about that down the road. Now, what I think is actually significant about the middle is that they very explicitly wrestle with a tension between the ideally desirable and the actually achievable. Something that over the course of religious Zionism becomes a harder and harder thing to do. And we will, I hope, get to talk about why that is. Right? But they are explicitly willing to talk about, okay, yes, God promised Eretz Yisrael in its entirety to us. But as Meir Bar-Ilan says, Providence also put a bunch of Arabs here. So I have to figure out what I'm going to do about that. And what's interesting is, I don't see in them any suggestion of surrender of their right to the land. Right? It's something else. It's a kind of, okay, but we live now. And some kind of moral recognition of the narrative of the other. Okay, now, I had planned on stopping at this moment, and I've only now gotten to the last part, which is Gush Emunim. So I'm going to try to do this in a very abbreviated way, because we'll have a chance to talk about this later. Now, I wanted to start talking about Gush Emunim in a very seemingly obscure way, partially because I think it's really interesting, and partially because I'm trying to motivate those people who think it's possible to have a traditional, passionately learning, egalitarian Jewish world. Strange association, right? In the early 1950s, there is a group of 12, 14-year-olds who begin meeting together at Kfar HaRo'eh, an agricultural settlement where they are students in yeshiva. Gachelet literally means like a burning ember. And these 12 kids fundamentally change, you can make your own judgments about for good or for bad, but they fundamentally change the history of religious Zionism and arguably the history of the Jewish state. So I'll explain that a little bit in a minute. But first, there's a tremendous amount of scholarly debate about when to date the process that gives rise to Gush Emunim. Meaning, some people say, what do you mean? Gush Emunim is born in the victory of the 1967 war. Other people say, actually, Gush Emunim is formally made a movement after the 73 war. And other people, social scientists, often say, well, the origins of Gush Emunim are already there in 1948. 67 adds the fantasy, or let me put this in a different way, the reality of the fantasy of Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, the entirety of the land of Israel. 73 marks a turn to political activism and an aspiration to lead the whole country, which we'll talk about very briefly in a minute. But already in 48, the utter novelty of Jewish sovereignty is dizzying to many young religious kids. And what's doubly dizzying is that Jewish, unprecedented Jewish sovereignty is achieved by fundamentally secular Jews, Perkei Ol, right? Heretics. Gachelet stands for Gedud Chalutzi Lomed Torah. Gedud Chalutzi Lomed Torah, we'll translate that as like a core of pioneers studying Torah. That very name is a kind of bold claim in Zionism in and of itself. We are both Chalutzim and we are Lomdei Torah. They are really the forerunner of Gush Emunim. These 12 kids are so powerful that 50 years later, they are all the leaders of the rabbis in charge of various settler organizations. They represent the beginning of radicalization among religious national youth, in which, and this is the point I want to make, both pieces are dramatically intensified, both the religious piece and the nationalist piece. That is, they become preoccupied with deepening levels of observance and chumrah and Jewish ethos, and with a more and more passionate and unapologetic nationalism. The combination of chalutziyut, pioneering spirit, and Talmud Torah actually articulates the revolution they sought to enact, and in some limited ways, I want to underline limited, they succeeded. Now, since it's late, I want to say this in a kind of shorthand. I think that it's more easy to understand the importance of these movements in sociological terms in a certain way than in intellectual historical terms. Meaning, I don't think that a movement like Gachelet and Gush Emunim later on makes sense outside of understanding the sense of inferiority that many religious Zionist kids felt. They felt inferior and they felt marginal to the Zionist project. They felt that the truly religious, Haredim, thought they weren't really religious, and the truly Zionist were secular and thought they weren't part of the Chevra, if you will. And so they're marginal mikan u mikan, right? They're marginal in both directions. And so what they do is try to beat both at their own game, to become firmer than the Haredim and more nationalist than the nationalists. And they do these simultaneously. That is really the emergence of what's called Chardalut, Haredi Le'umi. Right? The notion of being super punctilious about observance and particular certain pieces of observance, sni'ut and other things, and being out-nationalizing the nationalists. Now, all of this should be understood in the context of Zionism's incredibly complicated relation to Judaism, right? On the one hand, Zionism is nurtured by and derived from traditional Jewish categories. On the other hand, right, I'm not saying anything here that's a great chiddush here, it fundamentally secularizes, from a perspective of many religious people, liquidates the content of those categories. Right, so you might say Zionism would not make sense without the history of Jewish messianism, but Zionism fundamentally secularizes, and from a theological perspective, thereby liquidates the content of messianism. That explains the undying ambivalence of Orthodox Zionists to the Zionist project Begadol, right? On the one hand, yeah, they're playing out Torah values. On the other hand, they're enemies of Torah. And they're both true. That's the problem. So Gachela, 12 kids, they're 14 years old, they're at Kfar Aroeh, and like all adolescents, they kind of hate their parents. And they think that their parents are religiously compromising and politically sort of middle of the road. And if you ever met an angry adolescent, you know that there is nothing more detestable than being middle of the road. Reminds me of the great line attributed to the Kutzker Rebbe, the middle of the road is for horses. Thank you very much. I'm here every week. I didn't actually make that up. The Kutzker did. So these 12 kids, arguably, changed the whole history of religious Zionism. It's not clear at first what they even stand for, but they meet in this intensive way. They spread themselves out to become leaders in B'nai Akiva groups in various schools, and the religious Zionist leadership sets out to dismantle them. It sends a man named Chaim Drukman to order them to dismantle. Chaim Drukman sits down with them and is so moved by them that he says, I'm joining them. These guys are serious. Like, this is what I call chalutziyut. I want to join them. This group, they're like 16 now, helps form a yeshiva called Keren B'Yavneh. And then eventually all kinds of complicated things happen in Keren B'Yavneh. And here, this is really interesting. And this is a subject for sociologists. And I wish we had like many hours to talk about this. Okay? Eventually, due to various complications at Keren B'Yavneh, they move to a yeshiva called Merkaz Harav. Now, Merkaz Harav is a backwater. It is a totally tertiary yeshiva in Israel. It's Rosh Yeshiva, who is the Rosh Yeshiva only because basically everybody else has died off, is a man named Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who is regarded as an irrelevant eccentric in Israeli life. They, in a meeting that's a little bit shrouded in complexity, have this meeting with Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and it's love at first sight. They make their Rebbe, and he, for the first time as a relatively old man, finally has students. And what students he have? He has, they are this totally charismatic core. They were looking for a master, and he was looking for students. Now, here's the thing, going back to before. According to many historians, until they met Tzvi Yehuda, none of those kids had ever read a single line of Rav Kook the Father. Now, if those of you who know something about the history of Zionist ideas may know that academics often understand Rav Kook in a very different way from people who understand themselves as Rav Kook's students and grand students. And among Rav Kook's grand students, Rav Kook is read through the filter of his son, Tzvi Yehuda. That's because they literally had never heard of Rav Kook until Tzvi Yehuda showed it to them. They made Tzvi Yehuda, and thereby they made Rav Kook. The difference is that Rav Kook was an enormous spiritual giant, as a writer, as a thinker, capable of incredible complexity. Tzvi Yehuda was dramatically less so. Now, since I'm running dramatically late here, I'm going to skip things and just say a couple things about 1967, when this begins to kind of really burgeon. Okay? 1967, something very important happens. And this is not just true for religious people, this is true, at least for a brief moment, among secular Israelis too. The illusion of normality is shattered. Everybody hates us, and we're undefeatable. We are not a nation like any other nation. And in fact, the image that these students of Tzvi Yehuda talk about over and over and over and over again is the picture of secular soldiers crying at the Kotel. They have discovered Torah. That picture heralds a return to Jewishness. And even among many secular Israelis, their euphoria over the military victory is expressed in religious terms. And indeed, for a time, you can say, a search for Jewish roots is born. What Tzvi Yehuda and his circle never understand is how short-lived that search among most secular Israelis is. Meaning, they're still drunk on the search for roots among secular Zionists who have long since moved on. By 1970, let's say. 1967, the victory comes and they say, okay, we've been talking about redemption. Now we have redemption. Now we're actually beginning to get somewhere. Tzvi Yehuda says, now we're not in the vestibule, we're actually moving into the living room. Right? We're getting somewhere now. Now, here's maybe, if I have to stop short, I would stop short with this. Okay? Land, after 1967, becomes super central. And not just for religious settlers. In fact, the Greater Land of Israel movement, which emerges after the war in 67, is largely dominated by relatively secular cultural leaders and celebrities. And by the way, there's no sign in Tzvi Yehuda's limited writings that before 67 he had any particular interest in Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, in the Greater Land of Israel. He was part of this larger 67 euphoria. Now, this territorial dimension becomes front and center, and Tzvi Yehuda, who has a kind of, let's say, this will become clear, I hope, in a future lecture, less dialectical nature than his father, basically says, every inch we conquer is a step forward in the redemption. Every inch we go back is a step backwards in the redemption. It's actually that simple. Now, I want to ask for a second, why does this happen? The messianic dream in Judaism is about peace, it's about tshuva, and it's about land. And yet the circle around Tzvi Yehuda becomes completely obsessed with land. It becomes, in the eyes of its critics, a kind of monomania. Right? Its religious critics, including people who over time leave the movement, will say, there are actually other values in Torah too. But I want to suggest that what happens here is actually very simple. Right? They're inside of a messianic narrative. The long-awaited tshuva has not happened at all. We'll talk about this in the fifth lecture. Rav Kook, the father, his promise that the secularists would become religious has not happened. There is no peace. After all, we just saw that everybody hates us. But what happened as a result of this war? We captured land. And so understandably, that is an epistemological claim, not a moral claim. I'm not making any claims about anything not political, just trying to understand something, right? Understandably, the messianic dream is kept alive by saying, you see, there is a messianic unfolding, and it is land. It's the one piece of the messianic dream that can be plausibly articulated after the 67 war. Now, I have a lot more to say. I will just share this, and then I really am going to end and take some questions, okay? An amazing collective myth soon emerges around Tzvi Yehuda, and you should know this if you ever have spent any time around people who are loyalists to what's called Yeshivot HaKav, right? Yeshivot that are really part of this sort of Tzvi Yehuda line. They all talk about a sermon that Tzvi Yehuda gave on Yom HaAtzma'ut in May 1967. He's giving this sermon, and in the middle of the sermon, he stops, and he basically starts to cry. And he says, I'm going to read this in translation now. They divided up my land. Yes, this is true. Where is our Hebron? Do we let it be forgotten? And where is our Shechem and our Yericho? Where are they? Can we ever forsake them? All of Transjordan, it is ours. Every single inch, every square foot belongs to the land of Israel. Do we have the right to give up even 1 millimeter? 3 weeks later, Tzahal has all of this except for Transjordan. And the myth in Gush Emunim is that Tzvi Yehuda had nevuah. God told us through Tzvi Yehuda that here we go. The messianic process is moving forward. The train has left the station. Right? And we don't have time for this, but Tzvi Yehuda becomes this amazing myth, right, of their creation. He is, I mean, it's like amazing. Tzvi Yehuda has a stutter, right? Why does he have a stutter? Because he is an unprecedented fountain of Torah, and there is so much that he needs to say that the Divrei Torah are literally fighting in his throat. That's why he can't talk. He becomes this kind of like Hasidic Rebbe writ large. And a movement that began in a certain way by tossing off rabbinic authority now asks him every question. People go to Tzvi Yehuda and say, name my child. He becomes this kind of Hasidic Rebbe in the religious Zionist world. Now, I guess I'll have to find a way to talk about the title of this lecture, right? The ways in which religious Zionism is explicitly revolutionary another time. But I will end with this, okay? 1973, what happens after the 1973 war? Israelis are depressed, depleted. And the circle around Tzvi Yehuda says, aha, this is the chance for us not only to be part, we can lead the Zionist world. We are the only chalutzim left. We will lead this nation. And of course, what happens over time is the nation becomes less interested over time in being led by them. There's a time when it's more complicated. And I would remind you that it's actually, right, the Labor Party that enables the beginnings of its dissemination. The animating principle, in a certain way, of Gush Emunim, and it's rooted in Rav Kook, but it is this fundamental claim that as a result of being a Kabbalist, one knows that things are never what they appear to be. Which on the one hand, as we'll see in a few weeks, allows them to have a theology whereby secular Zionists are actually religious Zionists in hiding, right? It allows them to imagine secular victories as divine victories. But I actually just sort of want to suggest that it's that theology that ultimately is the undermining of the dominant strand of religious Zionism, in that it is consistently convinced that events unfolding before it are not what they appear to be. And that if one only looks more deeply, one will find the inner truth. And the problem is that this kind of dialectical thinking is totally explosive. Because every once in a while, there's a moment when you realize maybe things are what they appear to be. And what happens in those instances is violence. Right? Maybe things are, maybe Rabin really is secular. And maybe when they talk about land, maybe they actually are going to do what they say. Remember, by the way, that the day before the Hitnakut, Mordechai Eliyahu said, I don't have to paskin the question. Mordechai Eliyahu, former Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, I don't have to paskin whether it's mutar. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It can't happen. It can't be. By the way, you just saw it yesterday, right? Last week, when Shlomo Aviner and Tzvi Tau decided that Moshe Katsav could not be a rapist, what's going on there? That's a theology of Mamlachtiyut, right? Someone who is the president of Israel was put there by providence. I understand the evidence looks like X, but X is not true. Because he was divinely appointed, he could not have done this. It is that gives rise to What one wonderful old religious Zionist named Yoska Achituv calls the aspiration for Tzionut Datit Bilti Ashlayatit, the aspiration for a non-delusional religious Zionism. Meaning, because the tension of claiming to see things underneath the surface that are really what's going on, the difficulty of maintaining that has become more and more explosive. It's like a permanent powder keg. And that's why you see this content on the one hand justifying the state, and on the other hand, the moments of rage and vilification. There's a lot more to say. I'm going to stop here. And okay, I'm sorry, that was extremely long. Okay, so questions or thoughts? Yeah, please. And maybe say your name.
My name is Olivia.
Okay.
So my first comment is Shimon Peres gave a speech about 3 months ago, I think, at the Mass Iva movement. He said something that I thought was very interesting. He said there are Israelis that live in Israel that think that they can be Israeli without being Jewish. And there are Jewish people that don't live in Israel that think that they can be Jewish without the state of Israel. There are people that think that they can speak Hebrew without knowing the Bible. There are people that think that they can pray in Hebrew without speaking the language. And he says they are both wrong. And he didn't say more than that. I just thought it's interesting to hear lecture. And another question I have is, so you describe religious Zionists as people that played along because they felt they were saving lives. They created concern, certain time for them.
Explicitly, that's what Mizrahi said.
Okay.
I suspect most religious Zionists were actually, in their mind, in some kind of messianic unfolding, right? And we now know that Reinus himself was, sad as this is to say, a kind of Straussian, right? Reinus in his more public essays, talks about, of course, this is not, has nothing to do with Mashiach at all, and in other essays, it's much more complex. So I just want to put like a caveat. I'm not making any claim about, if there's one thing you can come away with after 6 weeks, the sentence, religious Zionists think X, is inherently as wrong as Judaism says X. Right? It's wrong on its face, because it's multivocal. But go ahead, sorry.
So I guess my question is, from my understanding,
and what?
From my understanding of history, during the times of World War II, the leadership in Israel, which was secular, made a lot of decisions that were in the interest of having a state of Israel and not in the interest of saving lives. And I'm just wondering what's your opinion on if that made anybody change its course or change the way they think about Zionism.
I don't think that there is a huge literature of religious Zionists taking on that question. Part of that is because I'm not sure how conscious those decisions were. That is up for huge debate. I mean, basically, to give you a totally unhelpful answer, when it comes to the year 1948, whether it's politics, ideology, or anything in between, you can find arguments and evidence for davar vehipucho, right? For each thing and its opposite. I have not seen, now it's not like I've read every publicistic tract of a religious Zionist. I have not seen any indication of that really being addressed head on. I think if religious Zionists needed to justify themselves in such a case, they would say, look, we didn't really have any power. We were marginal at that point. It's not a fully convincing answer, but I think it's actually accurate. Yeah, please. Pass the mic around if you can.
Is Sparta Jewry part of this?
What's
that? Yes, like that. Is Sparta Jewry part of this conversation at all? You mentioned a very deep timeline, and it's all Ashkenazi.
Yeah, so we will talk on several occasions. Here's how it is. Zionism is predominantly an Ashkenazi conversation, so much so that in Mirror, to Omri's question, right, Sfardim have Sephardic intellectuals in particular have a lot of, let's say, critiques of the ways that the movement was primarily interested in Ashkenazim and was less than respectful of Sephardim and their culture. That said, there were some extremely significant Sephardic voices who I think are extremely important in articulating a kind of moderate religious Zionism. In particular, we will talk on a couple of occasions about Rav Uziel, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi in Israel, and his most prominent student, Rav Chaim David Halevi, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi of...
Earlier than that, like 19th century, is there anyone in those...
They're individuals. But in the idea world, I could also list them on name. By the way, this would be another interesting thing that I'm not fully qualified to talk about, but one of the things that ends up happening in Israel, right, is that the really interesting strand of modernizing Zionist Sfaradim gets essentially drowned out by the sheer colossalness of Ovadia Yosef. In a weird way, Ovadia Yosef has an influence on Sephardic rabbinic discourse almost akin to the one Rav Kook has in a certain way on Ashkenazic theological Zionist discourse, meaning it drowns everybody else out. Right? When I say the word Sephardim in Israel, people think Shas, which is an interesting... I'm so tempted to have a 5-minute discussion of what Shas means, but maybe another time. Please go ahead. I think these two comments back there, and then we'll end. Eric, this is the first time you've been here and not asked a question. Sorry, go ahead.
Did the religious Zionists get involved in all of this sort of smaller sub-arguments within Zionism of sort of left versus right, you know, the Bund and things like that? And did they also get involved in sort of the levels of violence arguments with the Haganah and Lehi and things like that?
So the answer is yes. I mean, there is very much within the religious Zionist world, I hope we get a chance to talk about this, although I'm not sure we will, there is a very much a social left and a social right among religious Zionists, and it does not map on exactly with the political right and the political left. I use those terms not carefully. By social, I actually mean sort of social economic, and it doesn't map on to the Arab question, meaning one can be very left on the socialism issues and very right on the Arab question. But yes, religious Zionists are very much ensconced and enmeshed in those debates. And as for the violence piece, I will spend a lot of time in, I think it's the fourth lecture, sort of talking precisely about this, right? What are the moral constraints that Judaism imposes, even if it situation requires having an army? Is having an army lechatchila or b'diavad? Right? Is it desirable or is it simply necessary? All those questions are hugely on the agenda of most religious Zionist thinkers. And what's interesting is how many of them are extremely critical of any tendency towards militarization and the sort of unambiguous celebration of militarization. Tzvi Yehuda is a very big departure in that way. I'm tempted to say more about that, but then you won't come back for that lecture. Yeah, please.
At the beginning of the lecture you gave as one of the justifications for the whole series, the fact that we, you know, in our words and our prayers, you know, we say words about the return to the land of Israel. And so you say, you know, if we have integrity, if we believe in those words, then this is a topic of interest. And I was wondering what you have to say for people who interpret those words, you know, less than literally. Is there, or was there ever, or is there now a liberal religious Zionism?
Okay, so I'm not sure how the seifa of what you said follows on the ratio of what you said, meaning how the ending follows from the beginning. Meaning, the answer to the first part is, yes, I suppose one could take Jewish theological language and interpret it as just metaphorical. What I would actually contend is that in the history of Jewish spirituality, I think one of the things that makes it in some ways most interesting is that many, if not most, theological categories are also metaphors, but they're almost never only metaphors. Right? So when Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav says, for example, just to pick a random example, right, Yerushalayim bechinat lev ha'adam, Jerusalem is suggestive of the human heart, implicitly suggesting that every text about the peace of Jerusalem is also a text about the peace of the human heart. Here's what he's not saying. Therefore, every time I pray for Jerusalem, I'm just praying for my heart. Every time I'm praying for Jerusalem, I'm praying for a place with stones and streets and people, and I'm also praying for the human heart. From my perspective, right, I'm not sure I would go on saying these words if they were only metaphors. In fact, confident I wouldn't. Too many of them are too difficult. But when you then said, is there a liberal religious Zionism, I took that to mean something else, right? Which is, are there religious voices, let's say for a second, non-Orthodox religious Zionism? And the answer is yes, although there are two important caveats to that. One is, we can debate about whether Martin Buber was a religious Zionist, right? He was a passionate Zionist by a definition of Zionism that was alive then and is hard to sustain now. And he was deeply, deeply religious. He was a non-Orthodox religious Zionist. He called himself a cultural Zionist, spiritual Zionist. But one can make that case. Now, there have been Reform and conservative Zionists, but like Reform and conservative Jews in Israel, they are extremely marginal. Right? I mean, I would say negligible. Right? The religious Zionist left consists mostly of liberal Orthodox Jews, a particular segment of, for the most part, socialist religious Zionism. So yes, it exists, but it's not a phenomenon that exercises great influence in the unfolding of Israeli life. Now, that's merely a historical answer. One could still decide, right, that it's the most important phenomenon there is and I have to save it. Right? You could decide that, right? But in terms of its history, right, one can't really point to any major moment in Israeli life where, you know, anyone ever said, oh, the Rabbinical Assembly of Israel has spoken, right? No one cares, no one notices, right? It's 57 Anglo-Olim. No, I'm not trying to be, in other words, it has no, like, rootedness, bakarka, right? Now, will that change? Maybe, right? But as of now, it hasn't been impactful. It is the case that there's been a certain victory. People, including me, use the word religious Zionism sometimes too narrowly. Meaning, I thought long and hard, and simply in the interest of time, I did not do a lecture on non-Orthodox religious binationalism. Right? Could have done that, which is basically Martin Buber and six of his friends, but they were interesting people. Right? No, I mean, seriously, they were interesting characters. And I'd be happy to talk to you about why I made that decision. Ultimately, precisely because they don't really impact very much, despite Yoram Chazoni's fantasies to the contrary, they don't really impact almost anything. Okay, we really should end, right? It's after time. Okay, thank you all very much.
Don't worry.
I may not look in the right place, but